Yeah, no, but that's the thing. So, like, I record it, so we all have our own separate audio tracks. So that way, if like Alex farts or you sneeze or whatever, I can cut that out.
I
and no
just
one's
Dave
the
gets
wiser.
sneaky. Where's he holding the mic for that to be picked up?
I know. Why does Dave always get sneeze, and why do I always get fart?
Well, if you wouldn't fart so much, Alex, then I wouldn't say, if you wouldn't make an announcement, say, "Hey guys," and then we all say, "What?" And then you take your headset off and hold it to your ass.
The wink I do as well.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Films on Trial. I'm Gav.
I'm Alex.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Austin.
And this week we continue our best of 2023 season as we look at some of the biggest films of 2023 and we put them on trial. This week we're looking at one of the goriest and scariest films of the year. That's right, we're putting Evil Dead Rise on trial. Is it uplifting or is it... Oh no! Actually, fuck it. I'm gone. Is it? I didn't finish writing that, so I'm just going to come up with one. Is it dead certain or is it a dead end?
Not
quite
bad.
Good.
Off the top of your head,
that was good.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty.
I liked where the other one was going, but yeah, okay.
I think that's what it was. I think it started off maybe making an erection joke there, and then it just didn't finish it. Essentially, we're going to find out if this film will be placed on our esteemed hit list or our steaming shit list. But before we do, let's talk about our last trial, which was the explosive 2023 action film, John Wick 4. Dave, president of both the Lance Reddick and Clancy Brown fan clubs, judged that trial and surprisingly...
Don't forget Ian McShane.
sorry. Very long list. But yeah, Dave placed the film on the hit list. He's since gone away and watched it, and he's going to tell us now if he thinks that he made the right call, yes or no, Dave?
Yes, I did make the right call. It's definitely a hit list film. Very enjoyable actioner. I'm not completely sold on the originality of it. I think it may have been, I think you guys did a really good job of defending it and selling it to me. You may have oversold slightly. I think it's a good film. It's a very good action film. It's not necessarily one of the greatest action films of all time, like it may have been pegged to me as, but it's, you know what, it's decent. And it's a good enough cast. Some of them are there all too briefly for my liking, but it is a solid cast. There's not much of a script to really talk about. It's quite derivative of a few other action films. It's quite derivative of a few other John Wick films, to be honest with you. But no, all in all, it's a solid film. It's certainly hit list material. Maybe not as good as we may have made it sound, but it's certainly hit list.
Yeah. So just somewhere underneath Tango and Cash, perhaps.
Air Force
maybe
One?
A little ahead. maybe on a par with Air Force One, to be honest with you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And it didn't even have Gary Oldman, or which one did have Gary Oldman in? Is it better not
One.
To have him in?
Oh, no, it's as long as he's got an accent, I think. What was it? Joel's got a mantra about it, and Gary Oldman and accents and whatever.
Thank you very much for that, Dave. Now on to the trial. All of the roles have been picked out of the hat at random, and all of today's insults are descriptions of the best garden shredders and wood chippers that you can buy in the UK in 2024.
I have to say, I'm really enjoying this novel, and obviously... bottom of the barrel.
yeah, you would think that it would take me less time to do this than coming up with insults each week, but no. And bearing in mind that I used my work laptop once I finished for the day, just to quickly try and cram my argument together, I've got a feeling that at one point HR is going to call me and be like, so this week you were looking up reviews of chainsaws. the following week you're looking up reviews of wood chippers. Can we just ask, are you moving into a landscape business or are you trying to kill somebody? Anyway, all of these descriptions have been taken from gardenersworld.com. So acting as defense and trying to get this film placed on their hit list is me. And I'm just like the Hyundai electric garden shredder. Simple and light, but very noisy. And acting as prosecution and trying to get this film placed on their shit list is Dave. And Dave is just like the Mac Allister MSHP 28 fucking whatever. The
you take MS... that. Back.
Try it again. Come on, you better get this serial number right, just in case.
Jesus Christ. Title, yeah.
I'm gonna say the McAllister MSHP2800D2 corded 2800 watt silent shredder.
That's even worse. I thought you were going to say the uncorded one. You said corded. That's even worse. How very dare you?
He's easy to use, sturdy and stable, and can take on big loads.
Never been angry. Never been angry.
joining Dave is Alex. And Alex is just like the Einhell electric knife shredder, comparatively quiet, but can feel quite flimsy and wobbly when loaded.
good wordplay.
Now, just like real court advocates, the defense and prosecution will be making the best case for their roles. These may or may not be their real opinions, though, so do stay tuned until the end of the episode to hear what they really think. And in the role of judge who has to decide which list this film should be placed on, hit or shit, based solely on the arguments put to him, is Ozzy. And Ozzy is just like the Ryobi RSH2545B corded 2,500 watt impact shredder. Steady and stable, again, a lot of them are steady and stable, but he does have a safety flap to protect your fingers in case of jams.
And what a flap. Yeah. Yeah, but it's okay because the safety flap is one of my biggest functions, yeah.
So before we get started, I think that we should probably give the audience a bit of a better understanding as to what this film is all about. So let us spin the wheel of impressions. So here what we do is we read off the synopsis of the film in the style of one of the cast or characters from the film. This week it has landed on my good self. So how would you like me to read out the synopsis?
Evil Dead. Evil Dead. Yeah, I mean, can you do Deadite?
Can we throw it back to maybe one of the earliest podcast things I was a part of, and it was not long after I'd seen the Elvis Dead. Can you do it in an Elvis accent?
But like Bruce Campbell, Bubba Hotep sort of Elvis.
Jesus Christ, you're loading this plate pretty high.
I mean, I'm thinking Deadite would be good, but Deadite, there's a lot of like sound effects going on. There's a lot of vocal distortion that the human voice just can't do. I did Bubba Campbell, as I'm going to call him from now on. Bruce Campbell or Bubba Hotep, Bruce Campbell. Maybe a little callback to the original Evil Deads.
Okay, right. I'll try and do both. I'll try and do Bruce Campbell as Elvis slowly turned into a deadite. Okay.
A twisted tale of two strange sisters whose union is cut short by the rise of flesh possessing demons, thrusting them into the primal battle for survival as they face the most nightmarish version of family imaginable.
There was such a smooth transition between the
it was
the Elvis into the Deadite as well.
Thank you, nice. Thank you very much.
Nicely done.
Okay, so without further hesitation, I need to take a drink now. Let's hand it over to Ozzy. Ozzy, please kick things off.
I mean, the only thing I've ascertained so far is that this is not at all like the Evil Dead that I was hoping it may be. This sounds a lot scarier already. So maybe, Defense, you can just fill me in. What have I missed? I know this is, we're several films deep into the franchise at this point. Maybe I'm thinking of a completely different franchise altogether, but lay the scene. Where are we at?
Have you ever seen Rising Damp?
I mean, I live in a very old building. Yeah, I'm aware of it.
Well, just imagine that Rigsby gets possessed by a demon. That's film.
God, I'd watch that film. I would watch that. Watch that film.
Evil Dead Rise and Dump.
Don Warrington has to save us all. I would watch that, absolutely.
Mrs. Jones is with the maggots now. Okay, anyway, apologies. Right. Okay, so I'll give you a general overview of the plot because you probably weren't listening, and then I'll just talk about why I think it's a great film.
So, you know me so well. Yeah.
So you've got two sisters. You've got a guitar technician, Beth, and a tattoo artist and single mother, Ellie. They're reunited in Ellie's LA high-rise apartment one stormy and earthquake-filled night. But their reunion is cut short when Beth's three children, teenagers Danny and Bridget, and youngest child Cassie, retrieve a strange book from a concealed vault uncovered by an earthquake and unleash an unspeakable evil throughout the building. Ellie becomes possessed by an evil spirit and commences a rampage on the residents of the building, including her own family, where nobody is safe. Now, this is a film that has been made with a lot of love and respect for the original. And I believe that this is a textbook example of how you build on a franchise in a fresh and a unique way. There are plenty of callbacks and homages to the series, including the old traditional snaking POV shots of the demon, the comical yet explicit insults, lots of eye-popping chainsaws, and plenty of gore. But there is also a lot of originality to this film as well. The way it's filmed, the direction, the setting, the modernization, the character dynamics, and the inventiveness of the death scenes and the gore. This is obviously a film by an Evil Dead fan in writer-director Lee Cronin, but it's not just for Evil Dead fans. Those maniacs know that this is going to be a roller coaster of a ride through unimaginable deaths of blood and guts. But this film actually has what makes Evil Dead great. But in addition to that, it also has mass appeal as well. It's a very well-crafted story centered on characters that you actually care about who are put in genuine peril, directed with a lot of flair and great performances with a lot of impressive effects as well. It's fun, it's funny, it's shocking, it's scaring. It is everything that you want a horror film to be.
Okay, well, wow. Sounds amazing. Go on, Alex, you got a finger up in the air?
Yeah, just a couple of points there. You know, some of the callbacks to Evil Dead, I agree with it, but I'm not always sure that's necessarily a good thing. One thing that goes all the way for Evil Dead films is that, you know, the person's always going to read the book. They're always going to do the thing they shouldn't do. And I get it. That's going to happen. And, you know, that's a common thing for horror films. I found an Evil Dead Rise that took quite a long time. They go downstairs. They find this book in a basement. They bring it back up. And really you're thinking, right, let's get going. They're going to read it. But it takes a really long time to get there. I thought the characters would have done it a little bit quicker, to be honest. And I think a large part of the first setup of the film is waiting for a character to do something you absolutely know they're going to do. So I sort of lost a little bit of peril there. I think Gav's put so many things in there, and that's the problem with the Evil Dead Rise. He says it's funny, it's gory, it's horrific, it's shocking. It's too many different things, this film. And the main thing is you can't have both those things. You can't have a funny film which has an awful lot of like kids dying. You know, you can have one or the other. You know, it is shocking in certain moments. There are times when you're like, oh, I can't believe, you know, to actually see the deaths of children on screen. That is pretty shocking and, you know, very impactful. But then you've got a character who's going, and saying some horrible things, and then this sort of almost comical death scenes that are happening. So I found the tone, I found that the first setup a little boring, like, let's get going. We know where this is going anyway. And then I actually found the tone of the film after that, just, it was all over the place.
Okay, well, so too much of a good thing, too many not really knowing what it's trying to provide. I assume you've got quite a lot to come back on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, firstly, can I just say, you can't make a funny film about children dying. Try telling that to Patch Adams.
I think you just supported my argument there.
that little bit about, oh, they're going to read the book. It's like watching a Fast and Furious film and being like, you know what? It was just a bit too much driving. And they were quite angry at parts as well. But, you know, like, it's going to happen. It's an Evil Dead film.
I don't talk like that. You keep doing
it. You did at one point in your life, though. Now, I would say that also, I actually thought the pacing was really, really well done. You have this brilliant opening scene. It's like a fake out, basically. It starts in the setting that Evil Dead is synonymous with, that cabin in the woods, complete isolation setting. And then this completely like graphic scene happens, and then all of a sudden from that cold open, we move to somewhere completely different. We move over to a heavily populated high-rise building in one of the most populous cities in the world, where, you know, if help is coming, when it does arrive, it doesn't go well. You know, it's a completely different setting, and it's completely fresh and completely new. And so you've already had your sort of initial scares, and then they spend time, which I think that sometimes maybe some of the Evil Dead films didn't necessarily do. I mean, I don't agree with that, actually, but maybe some horror films don't do. They don't give time for us to get to know the characters. I think it, like, the pacing is incredibly well done. We get to know and we get to care about the family before the tension is really ramped up. And from the very, very get-go, we are shown that anything and everything is fair game. There's this real unpredictability that anything could happen. And it usually does in an incredibly visceral way. Alex was saying about, you know, not having too much of the original Evil Dead nods. I mean, I was a big fan of that, to be honest. I was a big fan of the original Evil Dead film, and I was also a fan of the remake in 2013. But there is just, for every great horror remake that is made, there's 100 terrible ones. And I thought that they sort of captured lightning in a bottle with the 2013 one. And I was like, I was very apprehensive that they could do it again. But you've got in Lee Cronin, the writer-director, somebody who knows the film, who is a massive fan of horror. And he has done what a lot of other horror franchises or reboots or extensions haven't done, in that he hasn't just tried to recreate the same thing. He's gone for something completely fresh. Like, you see it time and time again. Oh, it's Child's Play, but it's an AI doll. Or it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but this time it's full of influences. This is essentially a different spin on that story that we all know and love. Yeah, there's the book, but there's lots of new elements as well. I mentioned about the new setting with the high rise. The original series focuses on a group of young friends who become possessed and turn on each other in gruesome fashion. This installment instead focuses on a family, specifically young children, perhaps lulling you into believing that they, you know, that they would sort of abandon or lessen the franchise's famous savagery and gore. But if anything, they completely ramp it up in this. You know, they focus on a mother becoming possessed and turning on her own children. It really, really pushes the envelope.
And like Gab said before, it is hilarious. It is. Proper belly laughs. It was getting me out of that.
But like, that's the thing with the Evil Dead films, is that there is this humor in the terror. You know, you've got this incredibly violent and nauseating horror, but through all of that, there is still, you know, you're talking about like Bruce Campbell, he's an incredibly funny actor, and the character of Ash is incredibly funny. You know, but you watch Evil Dead 2 and Evil Dead 3 as well, essentially they're like comedies at certain points, and here it's dialed right back, but you've still got that humor in there as well.
Sure, which is good in those films, but not when there's a family involved. I just didn't find that. I thought that was where it all went a little bit wrong. You know, Gav was saying there was like lots of time getting to know the characters. I'd say there's too much time almost. And for them just to become cannon fodder and then disregarded, I don't know. It's just what worked for the original films, the changes they made there, it stopped working for these.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here as well because I have some thoughts on this. I've been desperate to speak. I agree with exactly what Alex just said. The kids are a little too young in this. I know in the first films, they were teenagers. And in typical 80s style, you know, teenagers played by people in the late 20s. But at least with teenagers, it's like you can kind of get your head around these terrible things happening to them. It's like they're not too young. They're almost adults. These kids are too young. There is, you know, people, Gav and Alex have both said this is funny. There's not one laugh in this. Like Gav says, Evil Dead is known for two things. One, the kind of nauseating shock horror, the kind of like the visceral, gory horror that like makes you want to shield your eyes from what you're seeing. And yet at the same time, this sort of like very dark humor that runs through it. Gav's absolutely right. The first few films, like Bruce Campbell is as much a comedy icon as he is a horror icon. And this film, I don't think has any humor to it. It's played too straight. And therefore, it doesn't feel like an Evil Dead film to me. You've got the visceral horror, sure, that's there. but the humor isn't. The humor is severely lacking. And I think, you know, having the kids be the age they are trying to deal with this, you know, sometimes young kids work in a horror film, Poltergeist, for example, where it's more like it's ghostly and it's spooky rather than, you know, people getting glass shoved through them and like things being cut off and disemboweled and things like that. You know, this is too visceral for kids. This isn't a horror film that young kids should be involved in the making of, I don't think. It is fresh. I agree with Gav. It's different, but The Evil Dead is kind of your precursor. It's the original Cabin in the Woods, you know, and that is what it was famous for. That kind of feeling of isolation that you get from the film being set in a cabin in the woods. That is what made it so great. With here, they're not isolated for a second. You know, even with the woods themselves became like another villain in a way. You know, the trees come alive and stop them from leaving the cabin. You know, there's this, and that in itself is bizarre. And in some ways, almost comical, you know, with the way, you know, the special effects of the trees, but it's still terrifying at the same time as a concept. And it's like that kind of isolation is not felt in an apartment in a city. You know, you feel like there should be a fire escape. You just outside the kitchen window. Why don't you just guys go down that? Or if you can get out into the hall, there must be a fire escape at the other end of the hall. If you've not got one in each individual apartment, there must be a way out. That feeling of being trapped, you just kind of like, And there's been an earthquake, but they insist on using the lift. It's like, no, there's an easier way to escape this building. And with them being such young children, having to fight off their deadite mother in this film, how come they can keep her at bay when she's trapped out in the hall? She dispatches an entire landing of the other tenants, many of them, you know, men in their prime or women in their prime who should be able to handle their own in a fight better than these kids. And yet they're dispatched in seconds. Probably just for the visual appeal of being able to shoot through a fisheye camera, so you get the kind of the landing battle scene going on out there. I think just for the sake of that shot, it kind of like asks you to suspend your disbelief, which previously in Evil Dead you could, but for the fact that the humor element is so lacking in this one. And also, I just want to mention the gore and the violence. Like I say, that is another must-have if you're going to make an Evil Dead film. And yes, it's here. But I just don't think it's as powerful as it once was. I think back when the first Evil Dead films came out, and you remember, we all remember the pencil in the ankle that occurs in Evil Dead 1. That is one of those moments which still, even though it's the blood doesn't look real, the ankle doesn't look real, you're still like, oh, God, that's horrible. With this, we're kind of desensitized to it now, I'm afraid. And I think the violence that he's kind of relying on and kind of being a calling card of the Evil Dead films, it just doesn't have the same impact that it used to. So I think although his heart may have been in the right place, I don't think Lee Cronin's delivered on either of the things that you expect to have from an Evil Dead film for different reasons.
On that day, do you think that it's because it's not violent enough, or do you just think that we're...
I don't think you can make it violent enough. I think we're so desensitized to it now that the kind of shocks that the classic Evil Dead gave cinema audiences, it's really difficult to recreate that. If not now, impossible. I think you can push it to whatever boundaries you want to take it to. You're not going to get those same reactions. Sure, you can make people flinch. You know, I'm not saying people are completely numb to it, but you're not going to get that same level. And if you're trying to recapture that by, you know, is it Bridget's character where she's like eating glass and you see the shards of the glass poking through her throat? And it's like, yeah, that's horrible to see, but it doesn't have the same impact that it would do back in the day. And that's not Lee Cronin's fault. That's just how movie audiences have evolved. And how films have not, well, Evil Dead and gory horror films like that have not evolved with them, and nor should they. You know, there's some levels you just can't go to. But in that regard, Evil Dead was always going to struggle to be a success once we left the 80s.
Well, Gaff, anything, any comebacks on that? That, you know, the violence it's never going to be as shocking as we want?
I think it's an absolute hypocrisy that Dave joins the bandwagon every other week saying that I'm this soulless, emotionless, completely dead person that can watch horror film after horror film and not feel anything. And Now he's saying that the violence and gore in Evil Dead Rise is not enough for him.
The difference is, it's with me, it's because, you know, cinema's desensitized to me. It's not my fault. With you, it's all your fault, Gavin. You did this. You did this to yourself.
Right.
When you
were three. Do as I say, not as I do.
So, right, just a few things. Right. Firstly, the setting. I disagree. I think that the setting, it just having it in a cabin in the woods again, it would just be a repeat, a rinse and repeat of all the other Evil Dead films that we've had. Putting it somewhere new is
really, really fresh. And you've still got that sort of element of isolation in a bit because it's this dilapidated, rundown apartment building in a very quiet part of LA, like quite a derelict area. And there are people there within the apartment. So you do have that level of comfort where there's a couple of neighbors nearby. But what really, you get this feeling that it should be this bustling place, but that should provide you with a comfort. But instead, it creates this intense and inescapable claustrophobia, because with the cabin, you could always like leave the cabin and you'd be out in the fresh air, you'd be out in the open. However, with this, the stairs collapse because of the earthquake. The lift is completely destroyed from the transformation of Ellie into the Deadite. To be honest, Dave has a valid point there about a stair outside. What are they called?
Fire escape.
Shows how many times I've had to use one.
You say you're out in the fresh air with trees that molest you in the cabin one. Okay, in the first one, those trees attack you. It's like, what's scarier is like trees that will attack you and molest you, or having to jump down a couple of steps in the fire escape because the earthquake's knocked you out.
It's trees molesting you, Dave.
The trees. There you go.
The answer, and he knows it.
Correct.
The answer is molesting trees.
The thing is that the characters don't have experience of both. They're not like sort of like, oh God. But at least we're not in the woods where we could get molested by those evil trees.
To be honest, in the cabin in the woods film, I did chuckle. You know when they had that whiteboard with all the stuff that could attack the guys? And down in the corner, there's angry molesty tree. It was just a proper callback to the Evil Dead films. That did amuse me.
I think they do a really good job of recreating that sort of isolation and that claustrophobia by putting it in a completely different setting, somewhere that should be bustling, somewhere that should create comfort, but it doesn't. I massively disagree about the scare and the gores. Earlier I mentioned that this wasn't just a remake, but its own film and also a loving tribute. It feels like massively against what Dave said, a throwback to classic 80s horror for me. It's obvious that Cronin is a huge horror fan and he makes some loving and well-shot nods to other classics like Poltergeist, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Shining, The Exorcist, Nightmare on Elm Street. And I mentioned previously how he does a really good job with the script, but he's also a very skilled filmmaker as well. There's a very impressive shot where he shows Ellie dispatching several of the neighbors that Dave mentioned before were all fit and young. And it's all filmed through the apartment's peephole. And there's several shots like that. Or the way the camera pans up, the room is completely quiet and dark and the camera kind of turns around slowly and then pans up and Ellie's on top of the ceiling. There's lots of great camera work, lots of great direction. But one of the great things for me is the makeup, like slowly transforming Ellie from a loving mother into a deadite with more and more disgusting makeup effects is just an absolute joy to see. And couple that with the brilliant practical effects that we get as well. I know that there's still a bit of CGI throughout this, but there is so many great practical effects. It brings a real tangible feel to the film and the violence and gore within it as well. Then you've got the creativeness of the crew to design and deliver some of these scenes. It's quite remarkable. Any sort of household item that is glimpsed upon ends up becoming a Chekhov's gun in some way or another. And most exemplified by the wood chipper at the end.
Isn't that how we watched it? I'm pretty sure we watched it just basically being like, they're Chekhov scissors.
Chekhov tattoo gun.
Chekhov tattoo, Chekhov pair of glasses.
Yeah. The thing is, in horror films, you can't escape that. You know what I mean? You can't just kind of like show a gun or show a weapon and the majority of the audience are like, well, that's going to come back at some point and that's going to be used as a weapon. And the way that he does it, I think he does a fantastic job of setting all these up, kind of sprinkling the breadcrumbs to be like, oh, we've got this, we've got that, we've got this. But he never lingers. He never fills it with excessive expository dialogue. It's just very, very well glimpsed upon to set up for later on. And then there's like Nick Bassett's production design, Gareth Edwards' set design, and Nick Connor's art decoration. They all come together to create this ominous tower block, this aesthetic for the film, which I think is a really, really great setting. With regards to the horror and the gore, I completely disagree. I mean, as we mentioned before, I'm completely dead inside, but there was still
like about three times in this film where even I flinched and was like, oh God, you know, like
it's... I don't believe a word of it.
But you watched it with me. Like it, there were times where you're just like, oh God, even that's a bit too much. But it's like, what I like about it is that I appreciate how it's filmed. You know, and like people can watch it and be like, oh, that's just torture porn now, or that's just there to gross me out, or that's there to shock people or whatever. But when you actually look at it and you think about actually how they've thought about that, how the creation process for that, and then how they've filmed it, it's just, it's very, very impressive.
What Gav's saying there is that, like, we all watch it and are horrified. Gav finds this beautiful. Do you know what I mean?
It is beautiful.
Where at the very end, when Ellie's getting shoved into that wood chipper, I'm thinking to myself, this is art.
This is ascended.
Forget films for a second. Gav could be attacked by an actual deadite and he wouldn't flinch.
But like, just one, I'm sorry, but one very, very quick thing again. Alex mentioned characters being like cannon fodder. I massively disagree here. I mean, there's so many horror films where you have these characters where they've got little to no traits, personality, motivation, development, whatever. And I'm not saying that this film doesn't have any elements of that. You know, as Dave mentioned before, you've got neighbors who are dispatched of with ease, and there's not a lot of focus on them. It's just like, oh, hey, this is a neighbor with a beard. This is young neighbor, and this is youngest neighbor. You know what I mean? But what you do have is five prominent characters that you connect with and or care about, that all have time to focus and develop, and they're put in genuine perilous situations where you genuinely believe that they might not make it, and in some cases they don't, which is so unique, because you watch horror films and you're like, oh well, yeah, they might be in a perilous situation, but at the end of the day they're going to survive because they're a child, or they're going to survive because they're the main character or whatever, or you know, yeah, the mother's possessed, but surely she's going to come around because she's the mother, and none of that happens. It completely always, it always subverts our expectations, and I think that is one of the, that's one of the good reasons that the characters are so young in this, because if they would have been teens, it's played.
I was waiting to see, is he going to pull the trigger on this argument? And here he
you
goes.
You know what? Dave was just advocating teenage death, right?
To be fair, teenagers played by people in the late 20s.
But the thing is, if it would have been teenagers played by people with 5 o'clock the shadows, you know, and like cigarette packs in their t-shirt sleeves,
and families of their own.
Yeah, like the thing is we've been there, we've seen that, and we've done it. Like, children in horror films isn't new, but children being harmed in horror films
is
a big taboo. Like, and the thing is that because there's been so many instances where children in horror films and they are completely unscathed, it is genuinely shocking, and like it's genuinely shocking when they are harmed.
No, I agree. It, and you know, Gav's like, it's subversive and stuff like that. That doesn't necessarily make it a good film. Like Gav says, it's taboo to hurt children in films.
In films,
like,
to be fair, it's quite taboo in films as well.
Yeah, he did. Taboo outside of films, but I'm not advocating for that.
He covered himself on that. I don't think it obviously is a taboo, but it's also just, it's just bad filmmaking to do that. You know,
it's
a reason.
Not. There's it's a reason.
Allow me to elaborate. It's bad because you lose the audience, and that's what happened in this film. You know, Gav was saying, you know, you have loads of time to connect with these characters. You get to know this family again. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I think what Gav is saying is a positive about the film ends up being a negative. The film comes alive when everything that Gav said about the makeup effects and the practical effects and the violence and the great set designs and production, I sort of think, yeah, the guy wanted to make that film. It's the bit leading up to that film that he just wanted to get through. That he actually took quite a long time to get to be honest, but that's where the film comes alive, and that's the film the audience wants to watch. Okay, the problem is the cannon fodder, the people who you're going to be offing in this, ends up being this family that you've connected to straight away with these children, because yeah, these children certainly can't, and when they are, yeah, it is shocking, but it's not shocking in the same way in the previous films when you're like, oh, that's terrible, and you can move on. It's genuinely like a little bit disturbing and a little bit off, because do you know what I mean? Some things can be subverted and some things just shouldn't be. Evil Dead Rise tried it, and I don't think it'll be done again. I'd also say there are maybe some things that we shouldn't become desensitized to. Do you know what I mean? Maybe there are certain things.
I'm not saying that.
Maybe there are certain taboos that should be taboos.
Hang on.
But that's my main gripe with the film is that they kill children. But also that you've connected. Gav's saying that this positive, it's negative. You've connected with this family. It's not just killing children, which is bad enough. It's children that you've grown to sort of care about, or that the film has invested time in you.
So they're not cannon fodder then?
And then they become cannon fodder.
You can't become cannon fodder.
You can.
You can't. Cannon fodder, like, literally means somebody that is just thrown in front of, exactly. of a cannon. You know what I mean?
In the second, when the film gets going...
But you care about these characters and you know and you like them.
It's not personal, though. You know, you might like the person you're throwing in front of the cannon.
Yeah, it could be...
I think our understanding of cannon fodder is a bit off here.
I think when you say "ah," you mean "my," and mine's fine. Thank you.
Says the man who says biopic. You know, like
that. People say that. Lots of people say it. God damn. I'm so glad we do this on Zoom.
I think Aaron actually has a point here. You know, not on the biopic thing. That's just wrong. But I think about what he's saying about the kids. It's like Alex Kintner in Jaws, right? That was one of the in mainstream cinema. That was one of those moments that was like, "Oh, holy shit!" Spielberg just killed a kid. Well, not personally, but he allowed a shark to kill him.
Oh my god, give him an Oscar. He fucking killed a kid.
But he allowed the character of Alex Kintner to be eaten by a shark in Jaws. And he's like, that was a shocking moment. Back then it was shocking. Now it's not as shocking.
Now
as
we've
it was.
Got the
it's
island, haven't we? So...
It's, yeah, exactly. It's been done to a degree, but Alex is right. Alex Kintner, we just knew for a second, 30 seconds before he died. It's still shocking because of his age, but we didn't know him as a character. We know these kids as characters.
It's more shocking when they die. It's even more shocking.
Yeah, but not good. It's just shocking.
Manipulative kind of way. Honestly, both of you bore off. You know, like if it was up to you, if it was up to you, it'd be like, oh, you know what, Sophie, you don't have to make a choice. Both of your kids live. Happy ending.
That'd be a nice film. It'd be a much nicer film than what I watched. I was very upset by that film.
Meryl Streep wouldn't have got her Oscar, though, I'll tell you.
I'll tell you, that trip to Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory would have been a completely different tale. Everybody just has a really nice time.
I can only imagine what you would do with that film, Gav. Jesus Christ.
All right. So far, there's a lot of food for thought. I know we're pushing on time-wise. It's sounding solid. We talked about the practical effects. One thing I just want to get in my head. So, does she transform bit by bit throughout the film? It's not like an immediate transformation.
Yeah, it's a slow.
It's pretty
sort of,
sudden, I think.
Yeah. I mean, but like her actual.
In terms of her visage, makeup wise, yeah, it's a slower degradation. But in terms of becoming a deadite, it's like she's attacked by cables in the elevator.
Yep.
She kind of like lapses a little bit into her old self, but then ultimately dies pretty quickly.
So,
and then she's
the monster immediately, her body transforms more slowly, which is what makes the
pretty
makeup.
Early on, yeah. They
and that's what makes
the worms now. So like Ellie, as we knew her, is gone. It's just the deadite inhabiting her body, and then it's a gradual visual decline.
So that's something like and Gav's mentioning there that actually you come back to that bit by bit, and it's a so that's something which you see develop through to the culmination, I guess, at the end when she is full. Deadite is the absolute monster.
Yeah. So. Yeah, without spoiling it, absolute monster is a good word.
Well, what about, I mean, it's a gory film. A big part of what makes gore feel a little bit more realistic, especially in horror, is the soundscapes and the effects. You know, is it as scary? It sounds like there's a whole host of jump scares, a whole host of just... goriness, you know, especially around the way Gav mentioned about really quite impactful or interesting camera shots. How are they? Anyone want to have anything to say about the music or the effects that go with it? It's okay if the answer's no. It's fine.
Well, I can speak a little about that. For the most part, quite good. I think the music, it didn't feel out of place. It didn't stick out in my mind. But it didn't feel out of place. And, you know, for a horror film, you're not looking for a sweeping orchestral score. I think it did its job. Sound effects, again, they didn't stick with me. And, you know, maybe it's because I know the story behind it. I mentioned before the pencil and the ankle in the original Evil Dead film. And maybe it's because I know the story about how they did that. That was actually a pencil that they jabbed into an apple and then, like, rotated it around inside the eye. That's how they made that sound. And that kind of stayed with me. Now, maybe it's just because I don't know the backstory of some of the sound effects in this, but nothing stuck out in the same way. Again, maybe it's a desensitivity thing. Maybe it's just the fact that, you know, we've kind of gotten used to seeing this sort of thing. But I don't think it had the same impact as Evil Dead normally should. And no, I do mean should before desensitivity.
I'll tell you right now, the sales of cheese graters have plummeted since this film came out.
To be fair, the cheese grater was a nice... But the one that came to my mind there, though, was Danny. When Danny gets stabbed basically through the bicep in the kitchen with a kitchen knife, the reaction is basically like, ah. And it's like, you know, we want a bit more than that from Danny. You know, you'd be screaming. I mean, maybe adrenaline kicks in. I've never been stabbed through the arm like that, maybe. But it just didn't stand out. You know, it didn't have that visceral.
There is lots of great bits, Ozzy. As I said, the cheese grater attack, the scissors attack, the light bulb biting. We're talking about like the black comedy or the black humor in it. There's a scene with an eye popping that ends up with the eyeball shooting out and landing in somebody else's mouth. You know, there's lots of very visceral.
That's not even talking about
the final scene.
Yeah, it is, Alex is absolutely right.
What did you say? Sorry.
Was it a child's eyeball falling into a child's mouth?
No, it was a man's eyeball falling into a child's mouth.
Yeah, which made it funnier.
The other way around, then it's sick. But that way around,
Lee, it's fine.
I haven't even spoken about the final scene, which is basically Ellie being fed into a wood chipper. It's absolutely beautiful, beautifully filmed.
Honestly, it sounds like there's a hell of a lot going on with it. On the bicep thing, I mean, completely to a tangent, may get cut from the whole thing. I stabbed John McDonough in the arm with a pencil, and he didn't scream at all.
Why?
I remember. I think
Ozzy was possessed at the time.
But he didn't scream whatsoever, because otherwise we'd have both had detention. And
did you have beef with John McDonough that we didn't know?
No, he was my friend.
Yeah, he was sound.
Right. Yeah. We got on really well, and then
but
the pencil broke off in his arm. And we had to squeeze it out afterwards.
Funny thing is, I actually remember this.
I have to say, 50% of you are scaring the absolute piss out of me at this point.
I mean, yeah, I'm remembering it and I'm chuckling to myself. This should be horrific. Yeah, I'm just desensitized. What can I tell you?
Yeah. So, does anyone have any closing statements before we move on?
All I'm going to say is, if you like children's deaths.
You hate children as much as I suspect you do, Ozzy. You're going to love Evil Dead Rise.
I think my closing points would just be, I think this film comes from a good place. I think Lee Cronin has definitely come from this from a good angle, where he I think he really does like the original films. And he's tried to pay homage, but he's trying to do something fresh and put his own spin on it. But I think there's some things you just can't spin. Evil Dead is kind of... it's pretty much set in what you expect from an Evil Dead film. It'd be like making Nightmare on Elm Street, only Freddy doesn't go into people's dreams. You know, it just wouldn't work. There's some key things that you need to have for this franchise to work. And I think Lee Cronin's kind of lost sight of that. And maybe some of the stuff that he's decided to keep doesn't work in the cold light of day with a modern audience.
I would disagree. I'd say that it's keeping to the same theme, but just updating or putting a new spin on it. So it'd be like making a Nightmare on Elm Street, but instead of going into your dreams, Freddy goes into your daydreams. you'd be dreaming about Chris Hemsworth or something, and then all of a sudden Freddy Krueger would come in to decapitate him.
To be honest, if he went into your phone, that'd scare people more these days. Alex, who do you agree with?
Okay.
Neither, to be honest. Neither of you.
Is there a quiz, Gav? Did you manage to make one?
I managed to make a quiz as well, because I figured that somebody...
no one else would do it.
Nobody else would do it. Okay, so these 10 questions all about
high rises in films or big old apartment buildings. Okay.
Oh, brilliant.
Okay, so question number one.
Ghostbusters. Two.
There we go. Obviously gets a point.
Yes.
Question number two. In 2012, Dread.
Skyscraper. Don't know.
Hey, Ozzy. Quite bored the other day.
Guys.
Oh, fucking brilliant.
Of course you did.
You'll have to come round and we'll have a second viewing. So anyway, the 2012 action sci-fi film Dread was a big smash and a big hit for Carl Urban. But which unusual name actually wrote the film? I mean, it's probably not unusual now, but at the time I was a bit like, oh, wow.
Alex Garland?
Yeah, well done, Alex Garland. Well done, Alex. Question number two. Die Hard, which a few years ago was rightfully certified as an official Christmas movie by this very podcast, features Reginald Bell Johnson as Sergeant Al Powell. But what is his snack of choice?
Twinkies.
Yes, well done, Alex. Two for two. Here we go. Well done. Question number three. Land of the Dead was George A. Romero's fourth of six Living Dead films and focuses on a group of survivors living in a feudal-like government state. The film featured cameos from which two British stars as photo booth zombies?
Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Oh, I'm going to give you the point, Dave. It's Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright.
So, question number four. Man on Wire was the fantastic 2008 documentary about Philippe Petit's 1974 high wire walk.
What was his name? Philippe Petit?
Philippe Petit.
Jackie Wilson song. Jackie Wilson song, that, I'm sure.
It was basically about his 1974 high wire walk between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Now, to the closest foot, how high was this walk? You all got to go. Ozzy.
In feet?
Yes.
I don't know. 8,000 feet.
Okay. Dave? I
don't know how many.
2,000 feet.
Okay. Alex?
4,000 feet.
Well, Dave's the closest. It was 1,350 feet. Aussie. <Neighbor. laughs> It'd be like fucking five Twin Towers stacked up on top of each other.
I was going to say, I think maybe I've just done like the height of one of the biggest mountains in the...
He's walking across Everest at this point.
Next question, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Which star set Japanese-American relations back to near World
Mickey
War II
Rooney.
Levels? Well done, Alex. Yeah, Mickey Rooney. Jesus
That's a good
Christ.
Question. Sorry for interrupting your question. It was well written.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I watched it again quite recently, and it is just awful. Absolutely awful.
You are like, oh, no, maybe you know, it's not as bad as I remember it, but it's worse. It's actually worse. When
I read an interview with Mickey Rooney, and he was like, what?
People find that, yeah.
People find that offensive.
You think, what's racist about that? Jesus Christ.
Next question. Candyman is a brilliant horror film set in the then real-life deprived public housing project High Rises of Chicago. But where was the original short story that the film is based on set?
Bronx.
Any other guesses?
Liverpool.
Well done, Dave. Liverpool.
Oh,
yes.
In the back of my mind, I was thinking it's set in Liverpool, the original. I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Tom Slemon classic.
Whereabouts? Yeah, yeah. And Candyman is based on Per Plaki. okay, next.
To anyone not from Liverpool, probably worth a Google as to who Per Plaki is.
Next question. Critters 3, genuinely my personal favourite of the series, was also the first film...
Are you
film...
joking?
No, it's great.
Is it?
Well, I mean, I think it's great. You will not think it's great.
Take this with a pinch of salt.
So the best in the series for me, apart from maybe the one where they go to space, the fourth one, but it was also the first film of which Hollywood megastar?
It's DiCaprio.
It is Leonardo DiCaprio. Well done, Dave. Okay, next question. In the 2010s, Hammer Studios made the return and triumphed with The Great Woman in Black, as reviewed by Films on Trial. Check it out. But what was the first of the new Hammer films a year before Woman in Black was released?
It was it Wolfman with Benicio del Toro?
Ooh, that was Universal. This was a film. Remember, Dave? High rise apartment.
High rise.
Pack the block.
No.
Would have been good though.
That's it. It starred Hilary Swank and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Oh, the Tenant. What's it called?
I'm going to give you a point. Near enough. Well, The Resident.
The Resident. Yeah.
Okay. Well done, Dave. Next up, question number whatever. Rear Window was the 1954 classic thriller from Alfred Hitchcock, starring James Stewart as a wheelchair-confined photographer who suspects one of his neighbors has committed a murder. But who starred in the main role in the 1998 remake of the film?
It was Christopher Reeve.
Well done, Dave. Yes, Christopher Reeve.
I didn't even know they made a remake of that.
Yeah.
Is it any good?
It's actually not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Not bad.
Is it not? Might as well watch the original, or is it?
Well, yes.
Well, but... I mean, yeah. He said it was not bad. Alex did say it was one of the greatest films ever made. And, last question. Once you get past some of the very questionable at best, morally bankrupt at worst subtext, Leon is actually a great action film.
Big sentence.
Am I?
It stars Gary Oldman as corrupt DEA Norman Stansfield. Which musician does Stansfield both rate and criticize? And why is this ironic coming from Oldman?
Mozart, because he played him in Amadeus or something like that.
Well, nearly.
Beethoven?
Because.
Oh, yeah.
Played
Beethoven.
Because yes. Beethoven was deaf and Gary Oldman has like perfect hearing.
But I'll give you both a point for that. So basically, Beethoven, and he played him in the biopic, depending on where you're from in Liverpool, Immortal Beloved, which came out in the exact same year as Leon.
Literally, every time I hear someone say biopic, I just feel like a validation just runs. I love it.
When you say every time you hear, is it you listening back to episodes of this
Stuart
podcast?
Lee. We went to see Stuart Lee the other week, and honestly, I wanted to shout across the room. He fucking said biopic when he said biopic.
I put in a word
to Stuart Lee. Say?
Biopic.
He said biopic, really?
He should know better.
But the thing is what Alex doesn't know is I put in a word to Stuart Lee and said, just sweeten the deal for him here, because previously Stuart Lee made the joke about how diverse his audience is, and he just went through the audience saying, bald with glasses, bald glasses and beard, bald glasses, bald glasses. So I thought Alex might be a bit upset by that. So I said, Stuart, do us a favour, man. Just say biopic.
I'm his people. What can I say?
You are, to be honest. You are. You fit the category and you say biopic. Anyway, that's the quiz over and done. Thank you very much, guys.
Can't believe there wasn't a question on The Towering Inferno, Gav.
I had a question on The Towering Inferno, but I thought that we've asked two questions about The Towering Inferno in recent weeks. So
I can never ask enough questions about The Towering Inferno.
How high did the Inferno tower?
1,000 feet.
2,000 feet.
It was 8,000 feet.
Fantastic. I mean, you can maybe see that I wrote in festive colours today. We've got lots of greens, lots of reds, depending on where I thought.
Well done, man. That looks organised for once.
Yeah, where I thought things were. And it's pretty balanced, to be honest with you, about where I felt things landed. But to keep it short and keep it going, I'm going to err on the side of caution. I'm going to say that this is innocent until proven guilty, and I'm going to pop it on the hit list. Bearing in mind I live in a flat that's relatively old, derelict outside building.
How many children live in the flat?
Zero children, so I've got a million percent chance of staying alive, I think, so it should be all right. I think it actually sounds really good. I think some of the... We didn't dwell on them for too long, but there was nobody to shoot it down. Some of the clever camera shots sounded like they'd be well worth a watch and would be something that's just quite an interesting take on watching a gore scene, essentially a bit of a horror scene pan out. And some of the other bits. You know, I think I like when there's a bit of tension built through the way a camera pans. That sounded just sounded interesting to me. So, yeah, I'm going to pop it on the hit list, and hopefully I haven't been lied to, and it is funny in a little bit of a... And I don't mind that they kill off the kids, to be honest with you. I think anyone in a film should be fair game. So,
exactly. Obviously, equal opportunities. Okay, so thank you very much for your summary, Ossie. And genuine opinions. I'll go first. I 100% agree with everything I said. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. And it was very beautifully shot. And I think you'll hopefully appreciate that as well, Ozzy, when you watch it. When you see somebody getting their eyeball squeezed out of their head, I want you to think, how did they film that? Isn't it very well done? So, yeah, thank you very much. Alex, go on.
I mean, it left a really bad taste in my mouth, but that's kind of the point of the Evil Dead Rises film, right? I guess some people enjoy that bad taste swirling around their mouths, like Gav. But it's not, I just don't think Evil Dead as a franchise or gore films are for me. But I think if they are for you, then this is probably a good film. Like, it's like Gav said, the makeup effects, the practical effects, the violence, all the great set designs and stuff. Once the film does finally get going and does what it's going for, then I think it is a very good example of what it wants to be. So yeah, not for me, but I do think it's on the right list.
Thank you very much, Alex. And Dave?
Yeah, I think you've made the right call here, Ozzy. While I've not bullshitted about my points, I have maybe oversold how much they mattered. I do think there's not as much humor as previous installments, but, you know, there's enough that it carries on. And I think, you know, I believe we are desensitized to a lot of visceral violence, but I feel when it goes to the level that Evil Dead Rises takes it to, you can't help but feel a little squeamish and a little uncomfortable, particularly that cheese grater scene, like Gav said. I think Lee Cronin has done an excellent job. I love that sound as well. Lee Cronin, yeah, he's done a brilliant job here as writer and director. It's a solid film, and it's definitely... If Evil Dead is going to carry on as a franchise, and that's a big if, but if it is, this is definitely a big step in the right direction towards its survival. And I think Lee Cronin has done a very good job. Also, big shout out to Alyssa Sutherland, who played Ellie, who is obviously the mom who becomes a deadite for most of the film. I thought she was superb in this. I thought, yeah, she gave a standout performance for sure. Oh, and that makeup that Gav said was super, because she's Alyssa Sutherland's a former model. She's beautiful, and yet the way she can contort her face and the way they can use the makeup and, you know, really bring out the darkest angles of her face. Like, she can look, for such a beautiful woman, she can look so sinister and absolutely terrifying at times. I think, yeah, they did an amazing job with makeup, and her performance was superb. So, yeah, this film's got a lot going for it. You've made the right call.
Good.
Thank you very much for that, Dave. Okay, so higher or lower than our previous film on trial? In fact, I'll do higher or lower than two films ago. So Saltburn, which got sick, just because John Wick 4, I think, is maybe the most popular film that we've put on trial. It scored very, very highly on both critical and audience scores. So Saltburn, which scored 71% critical and 79% audience.
I'm going to say lower, maybe, because just the child violence might have put people off.
I think lower critical, but I think higher audience, because I think, like Alex said, you kind of know whether Evil Dead is for you or not, and I think most people who went to see it will know. True. So I think higher audience, lower critical.
Yeah. Okay. Flip reverse that, Dave. Higher critical, 84%, and lower audience, which I was surprised about, 76%. So maybe there's a few people going into it who weren't fans of the original series and watched
taking
it
along.
Who got a nasty shot.
With a big fan. You'll love it.
Oh my God, the kids, no.
You're always saying how annoying you find kids in restaurants. Okay, right. So thank you very much, everyone, for your arguments and also for your judgments. And thank you very much to everybody who's listened to this episode. We really, really, really do appreciate you all taking the time out to listen to our show. If you want more Films on Trial content, check out filmsontrial.co.uk. You can hear us on any streaming platform and check us out on the socials at Film Trials on Twitter and Films on Trial on everything else. We are going to return in 2 weeks' time when we put No Hard Feelings on trial. So finally, I might get that erection joke finished. But in the meantime, what have we learned? Well, we've learned that Dave is completely emotionally dead when it comes to gore and horror. And Steven Spielberg did not kill a child that we know of.
I mean, I've not seen the kid that played Alex Kintner in anything else since, to be fair.
Please, for legal issues. Nobody on the set of Jaws was murdered. Nobody involved in Jaws has murdered anybody.
That we know of.
Some say that we know of.
A lot of people worked on that film, Gav.
Okay, Steven Spielberg definitely didn't murder anybody.
Allegedly didn't murder anybody.
Got to cover all the bases.
Reportedly,
here,
he didn't murder anyone.
Right, okay.
It's not confirmed that he murdered anyone.
Anyway, right, we will return in 2 weeks' time with No Hard Feelings. Well, we'll have hard feelings, but...
Speak for yourself.
Anyway, goodbye. Right, okay, we've gone way off topic here. All of this 100% getting edited. This is some of the most ludicrous stuff you've ever said. And I can guarantee that if it ever aired, we would be sued into oblivion.